Hey, deep fried fans. Summer is approaching, and I knew you'd be ready for a tasty deep fried dessert. Try a summer classic, you know, the funnel cake. We all remember them as kids, eating them at summer carnivals and county fairs. This is Ellie Mae here to announce show number 31. And in this episode, Keith and Woody sit down with Harry Pearson to discuss Iron Python and the dynamic language runtime that brings Iron Python and other dynamic languages to .NET developers. Harry Pearson is a program manager on the Visual Studio Languages team focused on Iron Python and dynamic languages. He writes the weblog devhawk.net. Okay, deep fried fans, grab that glass of sweet tea and get ready for some Gumpology.
This is one of your hosts, Keith, and this is Woody. Hey, we have an announcement for you before we really get started in today's show. We are giving away two tickets to DevLink 2009. That's right, two tickets to DevLink Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, 2009. Tell them when the drawing is going to be held, Woody.
If you get your submission in by June 15th, that is the day that the two tickets and the two winners will be drawn. Winners will be notified by email, and they will be announced on the DevLink website.
They will also enter a chance to be at the DevLink 2009 Speakers Dinner, where there's going to be a drawing, and only a select few will get to go to the VIP dinner. So you get to go to the conference, plus you get a chance to be entered into the drawing for the VIP dinner.
And remember, only one entry per person. So good luck, everyone. And Keith, what's the URL for that?
The URL, Woody, is tinyurl.com/dfbdevlink09. Again, you'll go to http://tinyurl.com/dfbdevlink. That's DEVLINK, the number 0 and the number 9. Click on that URL, type it in, enter your first and last name, your email address, press submit, only one entry per person, and we hope to see you there. Good luck, folks.
Good luck.
Well, all right, folks, welcome back to Deep Fried Bites. You're in the official Deep Fried Zone. This is Elder.
And this is Woody.
All right, folks, we're going to be kicking this show off here real quick. Sorry about the long intro to this show, but we had to give away those DevLink tickets to everybody. And
yep.
You'll be hearing that same thing played over a couple times here. By the way, I'm going to be in Oklahoma City at the 1st of June at the .NET user group. So if you're out in the area, come on out. We're going to be talking WCF for that lunch show and the night show. I've sort of got an intro demystification thing going on in the beginning, and then we'll be doing some heavy, hard-hitting production work with WCF. Should be fun. What do you got going on this week, Woody?
Oh, I've got two Microsoft events, two ArcReady events. So if you're in the area, go to do a Google on ArcReady. I think it's ArcReady.com. And also I'll be speaking on Wednesday at the Gang user group in Detroit, Michigan, on speaking on RIA services.
Very cool.
So, yeah, very cool.
And I'm going to be planning my camping trip coming up for Memorial Weekend. So
that sounds like fun.
It's going to be good. Fun. Going to have some deep fried catfish that's coming Sunday.
That sounds good.
My cousin can cook the heck out of them, man. It's awesome. Well, you know, Woody, we got this show here. We've got a two-part show.
We do.
Yeah, we kind of broke the show up. We've got this first part. It's going to be about, I don't know, the total show is probably about 40 minutes long or so. And we're covering Iron Python. And then we're the second half of the show, we get into a lot of open source stuff, which is really, really good.
Yep.
But we wanted to break it up so those that were downloading wouldn't have to download such a large file and, you know, use one for community to work one day and one for the other. So
yep.
Anyway, so that's what we're doing. So you be sure that you grab both of these episodes, folks.
Let's get to it.
Well, folks, today we've got a really special guest with us. We've got Harry Pearson all the way from Microsoft out in Seattle. He's a part of the Dynamic Languages team out at Microsoft. He's a program manager on a Visual Studio Languages team. And I had the absolute pleasure of riding many a rides at the PDC with Harry and some of his guys. And it was a great time. Harry, welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. It was certainly great to ride like Jurassic Park and the Mummy and those kind of rides with you out of PDC.
Yeah, it was. So. It was fun. I almost got sick on the Bart Simpson ride. I mean that.
Oh,
thing,
that was a great ride.
I mean, it's John Lamb was sitting over to my right, and I'm just like, I'm going to get sick, John. Look out, man. Oh, it's a great time though.
So go ahead, Harry.
I was going to say it was a lot of fun because it was the Halloween. You know, they had everything done up for Halloween, and so it was. I grew up in Virginia, but I moved out to LA for college, and so the Southern Cal Halloween spectaculars at the various amusement parks are a very big deal. So it was cool to be a part of it.
It was.
You know
it
what
was
really
cool.
got me about that park though was the. You guys remember the chainsaws that were there? They had all the chainsaws
yeah.
running,
minus yes. the chains, but they were actual chainsaws and. Yeah, it was loud. It was dark. It wasn't really a place that you could like sit down and chit chat with people. It was foggy and artificially foggy, but foggy and dark and noisy, and it was just a great Halloween venue.
Yeah, absolutely. It was good. Well, gentlemen, let's talk some. What do you say we talk some Iron Python and yeah. dynamic languages today, huh?
Oh,
sounds good to me, man.
I hear Harry knows a couple of things about that.
Well, I actually like to joke. You know, I've been in this job now almost exactly a year. I just got back from PyCon, which is the big annual Python conference here in the United States. And last year, I accepted the job offer on Monday, and on Wednesday was on an airplane to Chicago for PyCon. So my 2 weeks hadn't even, you know, barely started before I hadn't actually started the new job yet. But I was on the way out. PyCon is such a big deal to the Python community that we all agreed, my boss, my old boss and my new boss all agreed that I should go. So I went out and then came back and did my 2 weeks before switching over to the new job.
Oh, so, that was nice of him.
Yeah, it was pretty – well, my old boss was a pretty cool guy too. So, but I joked at the time that I was the highest paid Python noob on the planet because as much as I have learned about Python and I really began to enjoy Python as a language – I was not hired for my deep and ever-loving expertise of Python. I was hired because I was writing, you know, F-sharp parsers in my spare time. And when you write parsers for fun in F-sharp, somebody comes along and says, why aren't you working on the languages team? And so I went over to work on the languages team.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, we know a few people on the, or kind of around the F-sharp. We know Chris Smith. He's a tester.
Hello, Chris.
on the F-sharp, and then our good friend from Ohio out in Seattle now, Dustin Campbell, who yep. he's the Visual Basic IDE PM, but I think on his spare time for fun works with the F-sharp team. So that's a great language.
If you play with F-sharp in your spare time, you should be working on the languages team. So, but these days, Dustin is primarily responsible for sending out emails regarding Visual Basic progress in the 2010 and putting lots of funny clip art. So you'll have to ask him next time you talk to him about the Chuck Norris and the kangaroo. That's the one that went out today. Chuck Norris and a kangaroo.
Don't you doubt it. We certainly will.
We will
follow up with that. Well, Harry, let's talk some, let's get down and dirty a little bit with Iron Python and some stuff. And, you know, we had a, we had somebody write into us. We posted out on Twitter earlier that we were going to be interviewing him. And a gentleman on Twitter that goes by Vexty, V-E-X-T-A-S-Y, said, ask what feature of dynamic languages would really convince us, quote, statically typed folks to use a dynamic language. And I thought that was a really great question to kind of start the show off there. So we'll take your comments on that.
Well, I mean, for me, I think the most important aspect of dynamic languages is the flexibility it affords relative to static type languages. There's a gentleman, our Iron Python MVP, we've got one so far. His name is Michael Ford. He just published a book called Iron Python in Action. And he talks about the fact that when you try to do unit testing, which obviously, you know, unit testing is a big piece of agile development, the sort of the alt.net crowd is a very big embracer of this approach. And yet, if you try to do static type, if you try to do test-driven development with static types, what you find is that you spend a lot of time fighting the compiler. Because what you want is the ability to say, I don't really want you to go off and talk to the database. I want you to talk to a mock object or a stub or some other type of object that will fake out so that you can run the tests. And there are these various frameworks that you get in for statically typed languages that provide some mechanism for, you know, faking out the compiler. And you've got to go off and do a whole bunch of stuff with interfaces and generics and what have you in order to make all of that work. None of that stuff happens in a dynamically typed language. It's very easy to mock and stub stuff out because you have the flexibility to swap these kind of types and make changes and what have you at runtime. So all these sort of hoops that you are typically used to jumping through in order to be able to do unit testing on a statically typed language, they're just not there when you're unit testing a dynamically typed language. And it turns out that, of course, that flexibility extends way beyond just test-driven development. Any kind of space where you run into that kind of need for flexibility, dynamic languages provide that for you. I'll give you an example. I wrote a XML deserializer called XML to Pi, and basically it leverages the low-level XML reader functionality that's present in the .NET framework, and it generates a hierarchy of Python objects. And if you've ever done XML serialization in C#, you know that there's this large number of attributes that you've got to adorn onto your type and do all of this kind of stuff. You're fighting the compiler in that case. You're taking a loosely bound data format, XML, and trying to turn it into a statically bound type, set of objects. For Python, because they're all loosely typed, I can very easily come along and say, I'm parsing an RSS feed, so now I've got the channel tag, if you will. I can generate a new type at runtime very easily for holding the channel. If I'm gonna parse through a specific item, maybe I've got items that have different, or got elements that have different namespaces. Oftentimes you'll see, for example, an RSS link and an atom link in the same item. Well, I can generate two different types that have the exact same name, but are differentiated based on their namespace. And this was about 200 lines of code. About a third of it was for wrapping the low-level XML reader to make it a little bit more Pythonic and easier to use from Python. About a third of it was building a type caching engine, because creating a type is a somewhat time-consuming operation. So if you're, you know, parsing the same XML over and over again, the same type of elements, it behooves you to cache those types and reuse them. And about a last third of it was for actually building the hierarchy of Python objects based on the incoming XML. Now, again, if you ever work with C#, you know how much more code it is to do that kind of stuff in C#.
Okay, Harry, so help me out here. I kind of get what you're saying. So what you're saying is that you're going to take, or what you're really talking about is you're going to take XML, and then you're going to generate dynamic objects. So if I was doing this same example that you just gave of XML serialization, I would already have to have written the C# objects in my code, or I would have taken the XML and then created a schema from that and then generated the C# from that schema, but I'm still doing all this extra stuff. In Python, because it's dynamic, I could simply take the XML and generate those objects in memory at runtime and not have to go
and the types and the objects.
So yeah. You can mix types coming through on your XML.
Well, it's adaptive, isn't it?
I mean, it's very adaptive.
Yes, right. In dynamic languages, you have this concept called duck typing. And that's sort of adaptive is another interesting way to think about it, right? The concept of duck typing is that if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, then it's a duck. Right, so today in a C#
what if it craps like a duck? Is it still a duck though?
It's still a duck in that case.
Okay, all right. So, well, I'm sorry.
that's good for train derailing of thoughts. Sorry.
It is. Thank you.
So now that we've finished talking about duck crap, so the point is that when you go and you in a statically typed language, you do validation of types based on a name, right? Typically either the type name or an interface name. A class name or an interface name. So you say, I'm going to pass in here a collection. I'm going to pass in, you know, something that inherits from iCollection, or I'm going to pass in a list, or I'm going to pass in, you know, what have you. And typically within this function, you're going to perhaps, you know, do some operations on it. You're going to check the length of it. For an article I wrote for Code Magazine, I wrote a little bubble sort in Iron Python, right? And so you had, you know, for a collection, you needed to be able to tell its length. You needed to be able to read and write at a given index, and you needed to be able to compare the values stored in the collection. And in a statically typed language, you'd have to specify all of that in a type, either, as I said, an interface or a class. In a dynamic language, you can come along and say, well, as long as the object that I pass in here supports those operations, then they're compatible. So if I want to generate, you know, some random class from, you know, that it doesn't have to have any kind of, you know, organizational hierarchy that's compatible, right? So I don't have to inherit from any specific class or any specific interface. I just build a class and I say, I'm going to generate a length function. I'm going to generate a get at and a set at. I'm going to write those functions, and then I pass it into my bubble sort, and it works perfectly, even though that it's a completely different object hierarchy, perhaps, than what you would see, again, in something like a C-sharp language.
Harry, I'm interested to know how I can use, as a C-sharp developer, how I can use Iron Python to enhance my C-sharp code, and for all the VB.net developers, how can they enhance and use Iron Python well with their code? We get that question a lot, at least today when people found out we were interviewing you.
So one of the great things about .net, about Iron Python, is the fact that we have great interop from Python into statically typed languages. So I'm assuming that since, you know, this audience doesn't know very much about Iron Python, they probably don't know much about Python, the sort of the original C implementation of Python. But the C version of Python has this extensibility library so that you can build extensions in C. And it's this very ugly API. I've got a slide of it that you can't even read the text. It's so small. And this is to do essentially a very trivial, you know, structure available to Python. What's great about Iron Python is that it can pretty much access anything you build in .NET. There are some caveats. It isn't perfect. But if you're building, you know, typical .NET code, chances are you'll be able to access it from Iron Python as is. I'll give you an example. I've been working on a debugger for Iron Python of late. And there's a managed API that ships in a sample app called MDBG. And so I took that API, it's part of an exe, when you run it, the MDBG command line debugger that comes in the .NET framework, it's an executable, but there's a bunch of DLLs that ship with it. So I took one of those DLLs and started writing Python code against it, and it just worked. I didn't have to do anything special. These are just, you know, C-sharp classes wrapping com interop underneath. Com interop is one of those things you can't do from Python very easily, so I had to have the C-sharp code in the middle. So the C-sharp code, I was able to call from Iron Python directly with no problems. Now going the other way, C-sharp calling into Python, that's a little harder today. But we're making it a lot easier in C-sharp 4. The brand new feature that Anders announced at PDC, that other big, you know, that big Microsoft conference that we had a few months ago, was support for dynamic languages. There's a new keyword in C-sharp 4.0, dynamic, and what it basically says is, for things that are typed dynamic, we're going to do resolution at runtime rather than compile time. If you've got a C-sharp code talking to some other piece of C-sharp code, it'll go through like a reflection type of binder. So it'll go through and use the standard reflection infrastructure that's been in .NET since 1.0. But if you're calling into a Python object, you'll use the Python binder, and Python uses a completely different mechanism than reflection, because in Python I can add functions to specific instances, I can remove functions at runtime. I mean, I can do a lot of stuff that I can't do with a statically typed language. If you're calling into Ruby, Ruby has similar to Python but not exactly the same, so you get a Ruby binding experience. If you're going to be using C-sharp 4 in the browser talking to JavaScript, that's another scenario where the ability to call and get a dynamic experience is very important. And then also the ability to call into Office so that you can access the COM APIs of Office, again, via this dynamic API that provides you a mechanism to do things at runtime that typically in a C-sharp language you would do at compile time. Now, this doesn't mean that C-sharp is a dynamically typed language, right? I mean, if you define a class in C-sharp, it's still statically typed, but this gives you a mechanism to allow C-sharp and VB as well. So this engine is also in Visual Basic as well. So you'll be able to do it from either of these languages. You'll be able to call into dynamic languages like JavaScript, like Iron Ruby, and of course, like Iron Python at runtime, very conveniently okay. in both directions.
Great. So I was. I always have a question with this stuff. If I'm a ISV developer or an enterprise developer, give me a real world example on what Iron Python can do for me as a C# developer. I mean, what type of problems in the real world do you envision Iron Python helping an enterprise developer at?
I think one of the key scenarios that's going to be there for using C# or Visual Basic with Iron Python is going to be to use Iron Python as an embedded scripting engine for a C# application. Obviously, this is a very common scenario today. You have an application that you've built in a statically typed language, but you want to provide end users the ability to customize it. You want to provide systems integrators the ability to customize it. You might even want to be able to use that infrastructure to prototype out new features. And having an infrastructure like Iron Python makes it very, very easy to add that kind of level of scripting to your application. So there's a guy named Kevin Hazard. He's a C# MVP, and he's been writing recently about how to embed Iron Python inside of a prototypical shopping application. Oftentimes in a shopping scenario, you have business rules. These business rules change very, very frequently. They don't want to be kept up by the developers. You don't want to have to deploy a whole new version of your website just because the business rules change. And so in the scenario that Kevin's sketched out, he's storing his business rules as Iron Python code stored in the database. So then he loads those business rules at runtime. He uses the Iron Python interpreter to get executable code, and then he'll, you know, basically every time you add or subtract something from your shopping cart, he invokes those rules, and those rules then turn around and generate things like, oh, well, you've got 3 CDs from the same artist, so you get a 10% discount on those, and that kind of stuff. And those business rules then get stored in the database where they're very, very easy to change because they're just, you know, it's just a text stream in the database.
Are those rules that Kevin is storing, are they serialized as binary from .NET, or how are those? Do you know how you store those rules?
The rules are being stored as text, right?
Okay.
So
okay.
These dynamic languages tend to be compiled on the fly, right? You can, with Iron Python, generate assemblies that get loaded, you know, like normal other C# assemblies, though obviously the static type information is very different between C# and VB. Between C# and Iron Python. But typically what you do is you just, you know, you'll run an application, you'll just load the text in, and there's a in the hosting API, there's a function called create script from string. So you'll load the string in, and you'll create a script from it, and then you can execute the script within the context of Iron Python. So
it's almost like an eval, almost, sort of.
Well, of course, these dynamic languages, eval is a very critical piece of it, right? So eval
is
a keyword in Iron Python. And in fact, I've got some code that I've been working on for my debugger that provides a REPL experience inside the debugger. And guess what? It uses eval. So this is like, as you say, this is like eval, but for my shopping cart. So I want to eval the business rules against the shopping cart.
Wow, that's cool. That's very cool. That clicked in my head when you were talking about that putting in the database and just pulling those business rules or whatever you want out.
Well, that's like today. We store business rules in the database, at work, but they're workflow rules engine XML serialized, you know, data into the database. Then we pull it out, and then C#, we convert that into a C# type, and then it runs the rules. So it's the same thing. It's just probably a little bit more flexible, a little more dynamic using Iron Python in those cases.
Well, and you had to write a lot more code, right? So, for example, you mentioned that you converted into C# code, right? So there's probably in that scenario, you've got some, you know, workflow rule root class that defines the interface. And then you go through and you generate these C# classes that all, you know, inherit from that interface or from that class.
No, it's not really that bad. It's really like we're taking the rules API that's in the workflow rules engine, And then whenever you create rules, they actually get written out as .xaml files, XOML today. And so we just take those XML files and throw them in a database. But they're really, it's just a collection of rules serialized to XML. That's really all it is.
Right. Well, so in the case of Kevin's scenario, he's using them for rules, but it's a general purpose programming language. So you can do a wide variety of things in that. Probably the biggest customer of Iron Python today is a customer called Resolver Systems, and I learned about these guys about a year ago at Lang.net. They came to show us this spreadsheet application they've built. It's not really an application; it's a spreadsheet IDE. And so the idea of Resolver is that if you think of these sort of high-end financial modeling type of processes that some, of course, given our current economy state, I'm not sure this is the best thing to be talking about, but let's, you have these companies that, they model these complex financial systems, and oftentimes, what's the most popular tool for doing that kind of stuff? It's Excel, right? So you go and you build this, this complicated model in Excel, and then you say, well, gee, this is really useful, and we're copying it around, and you've emailed this around to 70 of your friends, and what we really need to do is to turn this into an application. So you go and you hand it to the IT people, and the IT people are like, well, great, come back in a year when we've converted this, VBA Excel-based application over to something that, many people can run on a website or something. What's nice about Resolver is that as you type into the spreadsheet, what it's actually doing is it's writing out an application. And so when you then hit return, it runs the application and fills those the resulting values back into the spreadsheet. And you can work with it entirely from the spreadsheet view, or you can go down into the code view and you can start adding functions and doing all kinds of arbitrarily complex things. And then I can take this application and I can stick it in the Resolver One database web application, and I can get that same exact experience but in a browser. Right, I type in a bunch of things into the spreadsheet, I hit return, it goes back to the server, it runs the application, and it then comes back to the client and with all the new results. This application is written entirely in Iron Python. Both Iron Python is the hosted application language, so the same way that, to take the example of an embedding language with Kevin Hazard's example, we've got a bunch of code written in Iron Python that we execute in order to determine the business rules. In the case of Resolver, the application that gets generated from the spreadsheet is a Python application. And so you can run it in and of itself. You can run it in the context of the client app. You can run it in the context of the web server. You can do anything you want with it because it's just an arbitrary application. And it's just the way that you have it display the results of running the equation or the spreadsheet that determines its usage scenario. Interestingly enough, Resolver One is entirely built in Iron Python. So not only is it hosting Iron Python, it's actually built entirely in Iron Python, which is a pretty fascinating case study for us.
So Iron Python, it's actually creating a presentation level or presentation layer with Iron Python?
They're a full-blown Windows Forms application entirely written in Iron Python. Basically,
wow.
These guys...
Very cool.
Yeah, when these guys were looking around, they knew they wanted some type of... They knew they were going to build it in .NET. They assumed they were going to build it in C# because that's what everybody does. But they were looking for this embedded language, and they found Iron Python. And Iron Python at the time wasn't even at 1.0 yet. But it was really the only choice for an embedded .NET language. And they had this crazy idea of, well, what if we wrote everything in Iron Python? And they said, well, I know what we'll do is that probably won't work, but let's start by prototyping that way. So they started writing in Iron Python with the assumption that any day they would have to throw all that Iron Python code away and move over to C#. Today, they are several years later. They've never had to make the switch over to C#. I think there are about 30,000 or 40,000 lines of Iron Python code. And they're also very heavy test-driven development guys, so they've got about 150,000 lines of test code to go along with that 40,000 lines of production code.
The first time I saw Iron Python was, I'm sure you're familiar with Jim, right?
He's my next-door neighbor. Well, I mean, in the office.
Well, I was in Redmond a few years ago. Geez, what year was this? Six. It was right after he had started. I don't know what year that was. Do you remember?
I think it was 2005, I think.
Well, it was 5 then, and
don't quote me on that. I've only been on the team a year.
It was five or six. Maybe it was five. And I was there for a summit, and Jim came in and did some Iron Python demos for us. And I remember sitting there, and he pulled up a shell, and he just started typing, like, you know, C sharp namespaces, or, like, you know, using system win forms and whatever. And he was using WPF at the time. It was like it was you know, sort of CTP ish WPF code. And he just started typing at the, you know, in the command prompt and just pressing enter, and then boom, a Windows form came up. He's like, well, let's put a little button here. He's sort of like the guy, you know, on PBS. Let's put a little tree here, you know. And
let's make some nice, like, fluffy clouds here.
And he just started, like, well, let's just put a button here. And he just started just typing, just like, you know, button, new button, and just put it there, put that there, and let's just change the colors. And it was all dynamic. It was completely dynamic. He didn't compile anything. It was completely dynamic.
It was completely, and real quick. It wasn't that it was dynamic, right? It was completely interactive.
Well, it was interactive. Right. It was more of an interactive shell, I guess you would say, at that point.
Yeah, the REPL loop, the read, eval, print loop. It's a very big part of the Python language experience.
Right, but I mean, but for those that never seen that, he didn't compile it. That's kind of my point. He didn't actually make a build and control shift B or anything. He was just in that shell.
Right,
And that was the first time I saw it, and I was like, that's cool, because I was a dynamic guy for a long, long time. Perl and PHP, and I played with Python for a while, and Ruby and stuff like that. And not as much as I wish I would have, but so I was blown away. I'm like, wow, you know.
Iron Python is great as an exploratory tool for learning .NET libraries, right? Because that whole experience that you're talking about, you do run into, you know, for doing user interface stuff, you have to jump through a couple of quick hoops just because you need to make sure you're running your UI thread separate from your input, you know, where you're typing on the command line. That's just sort of a Windows thing. So it happens in both Windows Forms and WPF. But outside of that, you know, the reality is you can do pretty much anything you want right there in that environment. So I can create classes, I can create functions, I can create instances of classes, I can import .NET namespaces. So if you've got some, you know, I've got to, you know, understand how this framework works, whatever this framework is, Python's a great way of being able to sort of explore it, right? I mean, of course, what does .NET developers typically do? They fire up Reflector. Reflector's nice because it shows you what the code is doing, what the code looks like, but it doesn't show you what actually, you know, running. In Python, I can very easily, you know, import some random new namespace, create some instances of it, and start poking at it and seeing what happens. And that exploratory style of programming is very, very critical to the Python experience. In fact, it was one of the things Anders talked about at PDC. He showed off some of the stuff we're doing for sort of post Visual Studio 2010, and he demoed a C# based REPL, the ability to do that same type of interactive programming at a command prompt using C#. The F# guys also have an interactive prompt today. And, of course, C# and F# are both statically typed languages. So part of my point about the fact that this is an interactive experience, not necessarily related to being dynamic, you know, those are two separate axes. So you can have interactive even if you're not a dynamic language.
You know, go back and punt just a little bit. Tell people who Jim is so that, you know, people aren't just sort of out in the limbo there, and explain sort of his role with the Iron Python project.
So Jim Huguenin is, as I said, he's my next-door office neighbor. He's the original creator of Iron Python. Interestingly enough, he was also the original creator of Jython, which is similar to Iron Python but on the Java platform. And back in around 2004, you know, Microsoft, when we did the CLR, we actually sponsored a bunch of different language implementations, and one of them was Python. And it turned out that implementation of Python did not run very fast. And so there was this sort of general meme of understanding, quote-unquote, that the .NET framework was very bad for building dynamic languages, because these guys had tried, and it didn't work too well. And Jim, having built Jython and understanding a lot about how to build a dynamic language that runs on top of a static language VM, like the Java Virtual Machine, like the CLR, he wondered, how could Microsoft have screwed this up so badly? So he sat down to write a paper called Why .NET Stinks for Dynamic Languages. And what he discovered as he went through his implementation, his early prototype implementation of IronPython, was that the .NET framework does not, in fact, stink for dynamic language. It turns out to be very, very good. And so he published his findings, and he felt sort of compelled to continue on the work with it. And we did the very smart thing of hiring him and putting him next door to me. No, that, I don't think that was the really smart part. it's not that it was bad. I'm just saying, hiring him, that was the big deal. And so he's now he's the architect for IronPython. He's the architect for the dynamic language runtime, which is what enables, you know, both Python and the new C# are built on top of the dynamic language runtime. And that's his primary, you know, role today. So he's a very, you know, he's been around the Python community for a very long time. And so we hired him to come in and sort of, you know, help take these dynamic languages, which are growing in popularity. In fact, it's interestingly enough, if there's a there's an index of sort of tries to determine the popularity of different programming languages, and C# and Python have sort of been neck and neck for most of the last year. And Python's currently on top of C# at this point, though that changes, you know, month to month kind of thing.
How is that measured? Just curious.
Google searches, books, blog posts. It's the TIOBE index, TIBOE. You can do a search for that online, and you'll find it. And the as of March, Python and C# are like 7 and 8.
That's interesting. What about, you know, you guys, besides IronPython, you guys also are doing, you know, IronRuby. Can you give us a little bit of backstory there on that?
So we did IronPython. We shipped IronPython 1.0 in like September of 2006. And what those guys decided, I wasn't on the team at the time, but the team I'm on now, what they wanted to be able to do is they wanted to be able to enable other dynamic languages on the .NET framework. It turns out that there's a lot of sort of common patterns in these dynamic languages. For example, it's very common to be able to create types at runtime. It's very common to be able to walk up to a type at runtime and modify it, right? So if I create a class in Python, I can walk up later and say, you know how you had this foo method? I'm going to take that away. Or I'm going to give you a bar method in addition to the foo method, even though I created the class 20 minutes ago. Or I'm going to give a specific instance, a baz method to this specific instance of the class. And of course, these are things you can't do at all in C#. So we wanted to be able to provide both a common mechanism for doing these in dynamic languages so that every dynamic language didn't have to reinvent the wheel, but also to allow for interop, right? So today, as you can imagine, if I can walk up to a class and add methods to it at runtime, that doesn't work very well with the reflection infrastructure. So the, you know, most of the basis for interop between languages that are baked into the CLR don't work very well for dynamic languages. So we wanted to be able to say, oh, hey, here's a Ruby project, here's a Python project, let's make them work well together. Here's a C# project with the new dynamic keyword we want to be able to call out to Python. So so those guys started working on something that's called the dynamic language runtime. And the dynamic language runtime is a set of common pieces of infrastructure that are leveraged in order to provide both functionality from the perspective of not having to reinvent the wheel, but also interop across dynamic languages. Now, if you're going to go build something like that, you better build more than one language on top of it. And so Microsoft's been building IronPython and IronRuby on top of that same dynamic language runtime.
So, you know, there's probably a lot of people that haven't really worked and got up to speed on the DLR. Can you give kind of a high level of the DLR, and then maybe we can go down and talk about how it integrates into the CLR and what it can do and what it does on that level?
Sure. Well, I mean, so the DLR is the common infrastructure that we use in order to implement dynamic languages. It's just an assembly, right? I mean, there's, you know, I don't want to get anybody worried about, you know, this is some kind of deep thing built into the .NET framework. This is the DLR today ships in IronPython and runs on top of the 2.0 CLR, and we're taking at least part of the DLR and baking it in the box for CLR 4. But this provides a couple of key mechanisms. It provides a mechanism for doing dynamic dispatch. So when you go and you invoke a function or invoke a method on a dynamic class, you know, unlike a static type, which, you know, when you compile a static type, all of the metadata about that static type is baked and locked down at compile time. In a dynamic language, I can walk up to a type, I can remove functions, I can add functions. I can add functions and remove functions from a specific instance of a specific type. So this sort of typical reflection mechanism isn't flexible enough to handle a dynamic language. So we have a common way of doing this dynamic dispatch. We have a common way of being able to cache these dynamic function calls. So for example, if I'm going to add two numbers, right, I'm going to invoke a different method than if I'm adding a date, time, and a time span, right, standard .NET objects. But what's interesting is that if I'm doing some kind of calendar application, I'm probably doing a lot of adding dates and times together. So I'd like my add function to remember, hey, he's doing a lot of these date time ones. Let's make sure we make those really fast. Common hosting API. So the ability to say, I'm going to load an application from a dynamic language, and I don't have to write a completely different hosting interface depending on whether I'm hosting Iron Python or Iron Ruby. And the last piece of the DLR is this concept of expression trees. When you build an application, when you're building a compiler, you typically compile your text code into a set of trees, which you then do certain operations on. And then you walk over these trees in order to generate your native code, or your IL in the case of .NET. Now, this is how the C# compiler works under the hood, right? You take the C# code, you build a series of trees, you do a bunch of operations on those trees, and then the last step of the tree is to emit IL based on the content of the tree. One of the things that we've done is that we've sort of standardized a set of these trees, so that's the way the DLR works. So when the Python code is read in, it's converted into a set of DLR trees. We then hand the trees off to the DLR, and it does all the compilation for us. So it's one of those things for reducing the bar, if you will, for implementing your own dynamic language. You don't do the actual IL emit. You hand over these trees, and then we do the IL emit for you. Which also means that as the IL evolves, you know, in the future, theoretically, we can take those same exact trees and improve how we emit the IL for them.